Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Friday, April 19th. Coming up later in the hour, we had severe weather earlier in the week, and we'll tally the tornadoes here in Iowa, about a dozen of them, I think more than a dozen of them. We'll see when we talk with a National Weather Service meteorologist later in the program. Also, Jared Strong of Iowa Capital Dispatch on how two veterinarians solved a cow sickness whodunit. And here's something you can join in, how you can volunteer to collect valuable data about the health of your local stream. Of course, we'll groove into the weekend today with CeCe Mitchell of IPR Studio One. First, though, let's check in on State House news. Stephen Gruber-Miller covers the Iowa State House and politics for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, Ben. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, and happy nearly end of the session, counting down the final hours. Let's start off with this, though. Earlier this month, Governor Reynolds signing a law restructuring funding for the state AEAs. Currently, they are the sole provider of special education services. This law also raised the starting teacher pay to $50,000, gave Iowa schools a funding increase. So this shifts fundings. This shifts funding to school districts, allowing them to contract with private providers rather than the AEAs. And Stephen, you wrote an article this week about how hundreds of employees have retired or resigned from Iowa's nine AEAs since the start of the year. Tell us what you found out.
Yeah, that's right. So as of this month, 341 AEA employees have provided notice that they have already resigned or they intend to retire this year. So that turnover rate is higher than the last year for seven of the nine AEAs. The AEA administrators tell me it's trending upwards and compared to previous years, and that they're hearing from a lot of employees who are leaving that part of it is due to the uncertainty created by the big legislative debate this year over this law. The uncertainty, you know, the legislation went through a few different iterations before they settled on the final version. And so there was some uncertainty about what that would look like. And I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about what the AEA's overall budget will be. So, you know, I talked to employees who told me that it didn't feel like a stable place anymore, that they really loved working there, but they felt like they needed to go find something different for their families. I should note also that obviously some of these folks would have retired anyway. There's normal turnover within the course of a year. But like I said, It is looking like most of them are having higher turnover than last year. And those numbers could still change because they're still finalizing employment contracts and things like that.
Right. And I think you noted, well, overall, you noted that the AEAs employ about 3,400 staff statewide in these nine AEAs. So that's an average of about a 10% turnover, a high turnover. But in what one of the AEAs, you noted, what, 20% turnover? That was the highest, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The Green Hills AEA has about 20% turnover, and they've seen a lot of people leave. And I talked to one of their employees who's leaving, and she just said she was surprised by how quickly the AEA change went through. She felt like she didn't think she or her colleagues were really given the ability to provide feedback into that to change how it would work for them. And she was saying that she's going to go work in Nebraska as a special education teacher there.
Remind us of Governor Reynolds' reasoning behind this change. I think she said it was top heavy.
Yeah. Reynolds has described the AEAs as top-heavy, and she has pointed to Iowa's special education test scores for students, saying that they're lagging other states. And yeah, that she wanted to, what she said was right-size some of the AEAs, so saying that there were kind of too many administrative positions there. The funding switch that happens with the law, what it does is it removes a lot of the funding that AEAs get for certain services called general education services, like professional development, as well as media services for schools. So it's in a lot of those areas that the AEAs are expecting cuts, and they're uncertain, like when positions come open, if they're really going to have the budget to fill them in the coming years.
How has the governor responded to this higher than normal turnover?
Yeah, she said that it's the reality of a business, that employees turn over. She described the AEAs as a business that offers special education, education and media services, and said that they need to learn to essentially be able to provide those services in a new way. And to be fair, that's what a lot of the AEA directors I talked to are saying, that they're going to have to figure out a way to still offer high quality services, and that the employees that they have staying there are committed to doing that.
Right. Democrats, though, according to your article, not in agreement with Reynolds calling them businesses.
Yeah, Democrats have taken a different view of this than the governor the whole time. They criticize her use of the phrasing, right, of right-sizing and of being like a business. They said that kids deserve unique, individualized services and not to run it like a business.
Yeah. What are the AEA administrators telling you about how they're approaching replacing all that staff turnover?
Yeah, like I was saying, some of them are holding positions open. If somebody has retired or resigned, just until they know a little bit more about their budget. With the legislature close to adjourning, we will get a final state budget soon. And typically in most years, the state budget actually cuts some money out of the AEA budget. So they're waiting to see how much that might be and how that will affect them. They're talking with school districts about what services the school districts want from the AEAs in the future, because the model has now shifted to more of a fee for service, where the AEA offers a service and a school district can choose whether they want to pay for it. So they're trying to take stock of all those services that they offer that school districts have taken advantage of, and see if those districts still want all of those things or if they want something else. And that will help determine which positions they fill.
Stephen Gruber-Miller covers the Iowa State House and politics for The Register. Let's finish up, Stephen, by perhaps giving you a rundown of what's happening in these final hours. I understand a late-night session yesterday. What are lawmakers busy with as it appears we're counting down the final hours, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, let's hope so. I was at the Capitol late last night. The House wrapped up around 1:45 a.m., passing several budgets. So they're just trying to get all their final pieces across the finish line. And mostly what that does involve is passing the budgets. Several of those are done, and the remainder, I think, are being taken up today. One of the sticking points last night was the education budget, where there's $10 million for a new division of special education to take over some oversight of that from the AEAs. There's also a prohibition on diversity, equity, and inclusion positions at the state's universities. So those were some talking points last night. But I think there's a push. Lawmakers are hoping to finish up their work, hopefully today, possibly still tomorrow. But I think they have made a lot of progress. And one of the pieces of progress they've made is a big deal on tax cuts. They're planning to speed up and deepen the flat tax that Iowa has coming into effect. That will take the state to a 3.8% flat income tax rate next year. That's faster and further than a 3.9% rate by 2026. That's the current law.
Yeah. And at the same time, GOP legislators moving to make a flat tax part of the Iowa Constitution, aren't they?
Yeah, they're proposing a pair of constitutional amendments this year. Now, this is a multi-year process, so nothing will change this year. But what they're doing is they're moving to say that if the state does offer an income tax, it has to be a single rate rather than a graduated income tax system with multiple rates. And the other one they're doing is they would like to require any income tax increases to take a 2/3 vote of the Iowa legislature in the future. Now, both of those amendments still would need to be passed by a future General Assembly before they could be put on a ballot and Iowans would have the chance to vote on those.
Also this week, I saw a bill to raise pay for lawmakers with bipartisan support. Has that gone through?
It's passed the House, and I would say it faces an uncertain future in the Senate. This bill really came from the House side. They have had a lot of their retiring colleagues stand up and say it's important to raise lawmakers' pay because you're going to price people out, essentially. Lower income people won't be able to afford to be legislators, and you'll lose that type of representation in the legislature. There's somebody who's retiring because they're having a kid and they can't really afford to be a lawmaker anymore. So that was the rationale on the House side. The Senate, like I said, they don't have their own bill on this. It's up to them whether they take the House bill or not, but they haven't been the driving force here.
All right. And we're speaking on Friday morning here. So in the hours to come, that may change. We may hear news on that, just for our listeners to be aware of that. The what else here should we note here? Possible big changes to the Iowa Civil Rights Commission?
Yeah, the governor has been pursuing a consolidation of many of the state's boards and commissions this year. And that bill has taken different forms, but it seems like lawmakers are getting close to a final version. And as you mentioned, one of the concerns the Democrats have raised is how it changes the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, which hears employment discrimination cases, housing discrimination, other cases of discrimination in Iowa. And that commission is made up of seven commissioners appointed by the governor, and they, you know, kind of have the authority to hear those cases, make decisions, write rules for enforcing things. And some of those duties would be transferred to the state's Office of Civil Rights, which is led by a single director appointed by the governor. And the commission would their role would be less prominent. They would have a more advisory role and still be able to do some of the things that they do. But a lot of the authority would be transferred over to that director who's under control of the governor. And the size of the commission would also be reduced.
Okay. Well, look, Stephen Gruber Miller, thanks for the excellent coverage this session. And I imagine you have a well-earned rest of sorts in sight for you. It's always for legislative state house reporters a real scramble for several months to make sure the things are covered. Stephen, thank you so much.
The end is in sight. Thanks, Ben.
All right. Stephen Gruber Miller of the Des Moines Register. Coming up after a short break, Jared Strong of Iowa Capital Dispatch with how a story of how two veterinarians solved a cow sickness whodunit. Also, how you can volunteer to collect valuable data about the health of your local stream. And toward the end of the program, we'll groove into the weekend with IPR's C.C. Mitchell. More to come on this News Buzz edition. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up a little later, we'll discuss the tornadoes in Iowa earlier this week and whether this week's rainfall has impacted our years-long drought in the state. I'll talk with Alan Curtis of the National Weather Service that in just a moment. But first, a whodunit story that involves sick cows and cats. Joining me now, Jared Strong, senior reporter with Iowa Capital Dispatch. Hi, Jared.
Hey, Ben.
The bird flu, we've heard in our news, recently found in cows for the first time, and you wrote about how this was discovered in an article. The first clues that something was wrong surfaced in Texas. What was noticed there and when?
Well, it all sort of began in February. Cows were showing some sort of mysterious symptoms that they just couldn't figure out what was causing it. It was an affliction that lasted for more than a week before the cows appeared to fully recover. They had decreased milk production. The milk they were producing was thicker than usual, and they overall the sick cows had a lack of appetite. So the investigation really picked up steam in March as more herds were discovered, and as people continued, they couldn't figure out what was going on.
Right, and you checked in with a veterinarian in Amarillo, Texas, happening to be an Iowa native now in Texas, Dr. Barb Peterson, and she was part of this investigation, so to speak.
Yeah, Barb, and there are a lot of other vets in the area that were trying to figure this out. They're collecting samples of basically whatever they could, you know, saliva, nasal swabs, milk, feces, and they had labs test for probably more than 200 potential causes. When they kept running into a brick wall, she reached out to an old classmate from Iowa State, Dr. Drew Magstead. They talk now and again on cases that are kind of hard to solve, and he works up at the ISU Vet Diagnostic Lab. And together they kind of concluded that it was likely some sort of problem with the cow's food. Sometimes feed producers will kind of fiddle with their recipes, and that can impact the cows. So they plan to go that route. But then there was kind of another wrinkle to the situation. Farm cats started dying at some of these dairies. Their brains had hemorrhaged, which is a potential complication of influenza. You know, rabies can cause that too, but they ruled that out. So the theory was that whatever was killing these cats might have come from them drinking milk from some of these sick cows that were infected.
Mm. And that, with the help of the ISU Diagnostic Lab, was confirmed, in fact, confirmed that there is a tie-in to bird flu.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was a real long shot. That, you know, bird flu has been circulating for a number of years now. It had never been known to infect cattle in the United States, so both of them were pretty reluctant to pin it on that right away. But Dr. Magstead did an initial test when he got the samples from Texas, and just to rule out bird flu, basically tested for it. And lo and behold, it came up positive.
Yeah, as we heard in our news. So what have you found out, Jared, about the implications of this? So the bird flu has jumped to the cows species, to the bovine species.
Yeah, and, you know, initially it was kind of confined to Texas. Southwest Kansas had a couple affected herds, New Mexico, so it was all kind of down in that area. But it's since been detected in herds in other states a long ways away, you know, North Carolina, South Dakota, Idaho. There's still a lot of investigation to be done, but it's believed that that was the result of infected cows being transported from Texas to those different sites. Now, the troubling aspect of all this is that it appears that some of the infections have been caused by cow-to-cow transmissions. And so that, rather than it just being birds that might be infecting cattle, the fact that it can go from one cow to another sort of heightens that threat of it continuing to spread.
Mm-hmm. What about possible transmission to humans? You have to ask, is milk safe? We had the cats dying, but they're not drinking pasteurized milk. Does that make it safe, our pasteurized milk?
Yes. I mean, federal regulators have said, you know, even if some of the milk from sick cows were to have been treated and got into the milk supply, it should be safe. But none of that is reaching the milk supply. I mean, they don't milk from sick cows is discarded or used for something else besides human consumption. And there was one instance of a dairy farm worker who worked closely with these infected cows. He was infected, although it appeared to be, it was conjunctivitis, so like pink eye, you know, so it was likely that the transmission was just like directly to his eye. So there's not really much concern right now that humans would be able to catch it from an animal through like aerosol droplets or something like that, that would cause a more rapid and more widespread transmission.
Okay. Alarming nonetheless. What is being watched here? How will you be watching this story going forward?
Well, I mean, states have reacted differently to this. I mean, some of them have outright banned cattle imports from Texas. Others have required medical screenings before cows are allowed to be transported. I'm not aware that Iowa has done something similar, but they are encouraging dairy farms, really any kind of livestock producer, poultry farmer, to heighten their biosecurity and to be sure that they report sick animals.
Okay, one other story you've been reporting on this week, another development in the very long multi-year carbon pipeline saga here in Iowa. This particular chapter in Dickinson County in northwest Iowa, that's the Okoboji area. What happened there?
Well, county supervisors approved this week a new ordinance that put some restrictions on where a carbon dioxide pipeline can be placed. They've implemented a so-called setback distance of 1,600 feet that the pipeline would have to be away from cities and homes, and some other distances for other sensitive sites like medical facilities, churches, parks, and stuff like that. The noteworthy aspect of this is that they are the sixth county to do this in response to Summit's proposed pipeline, and all five others who have done it have been sued in federal court. So Dickinson tried to tailor their ordinance in a way to avoid litigation. It's not quite as restrictive. A lot of the others impose a 2-mile setback distance between cities and the pipeline. But a federal judge ruled in December that on two of those ordinances, or the lawsuits associated with two of those ordinances, that they were so restrictive that they would essentially eliminate the possibility for a carbon dioxide pipeline to be placed in those counties.
Yeah. And Jared, remind us of the concerns, because these supervisors in Dickinson County had to, you know, take into account the worried residents right there. Remind us of the concerns of perhaps a rupture in a carbon pipeline. What could happen there?
Yeah. There was an instance in Mississippi a few years back in which there was a catastrophic pipeline breach. And it created this plume of carbon dioxide that stayed close to the ground because of sort of the atmospheric conditions at that time. It traveled, at least a mile to a nearby town. And folks are worried about that happening here. Federal regulators have said that that's a rarity, that it's pretty unlikely for something like that to happen, that typically when there is a pipeline rupture, the carbon dioxide will dissipate on its own without affecting people, but there's always a chance for it.
Yeah. So with this latest chapter on carbon pipelines, the proposed pipelines here, what is the overall outlook for the Summit pipeline, the other pipelines here?
There was one sort of competing project proposed by Navigator CO2. They've since abandoned that. And Summit has scooped up most of the ethanol producers that Navigator had planned to connect to. So Summit's project has expanded considerably. Summit's on the cusp of getting a decision on its permit in Iowa. It could happen any day. It could be tomorrow. But it's had setbacks in other states, importantly in North and South Dakota. North Dakota is currently reviewing Summit's permit request, and the company is reconfiguring its route in South Dakota and plans to reapply there at some point.
Jared Strong, senior reporter with Iowa Capital Dispatch. Thank you, Jared.
Thanks, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thunderstorms, hail, a number of tornadoes in the state earlier this week, Tuesday, a wide range of severe weather. I don't know how it was for you. It gave me a little concern looking out at the heavily swaying trees, the torrents of rain. Took me back to that devastating derecho back in 2020. This week's storms causing damage to some farmsteads and homes in rural areas of the state. No injuries having been reported, though, thankfully. Iowa tornado survivor Doug Wallman and his wife fled their farm near Mediapolis. Here's some of what he had to say to AccuWeather afterwards, surveying the considerable damage on his farm.
Watched it come across there. kind of washed it and knew it was time to get going. So I told her to look out the window and seen a couple little funnels form, but never materialized. And then the time I come across the field and I could see the dirt, we just jumped in the pickup and took off because didn't want to get stuck in here. You know, it was just something you knew you had to get away from. We just took off, went down the road about a mile, and turned around and come home. That's all it is, just gone. Everything. I knew something was gonna happen, but not like it did. I wasn't expecting this at all. But as long as nobody got hurt, I've lived here for 50 years. Never happened like that before.
Iowa tornado survivor Doug Wallman this week, looking at the devastation of his farm near Mediapolis. Joined now by Alan Curtis, National Weather Service meteorologist. Hi, Alan.
Hi, happy to be here.
I don't know if you know about that specific tornado near Mediapolis, but tell us what you do know about how many tornadoes touched down in the state.
Yeah, and like you said, Tuesday was an eventful one across the state. Pretty much wherever you were, you saw some sort of thunderstorm. And the clip, you know, we all just heard there near Mediapolis was actually the longest lived and strongest tornado of the day. So for those unfamiliar, that's southeast Iowa, kind of near Mount Pleasant and Burlington, just north of there, actually. And that specific tornado, we have an initial track of just north of 40 miles long. And for those interested in ratings, you know, we're looking at a preliminary EF2 rating, so certainly nothing to toy with. But aside from that, the rest of the state, so far we have 12 additional confirmed tornadoes, so 13 total confirmed across the state. The one we just talked about was the strongest and longest lived. Most of the rest had little to no damage, fortunately, and were very short-lived. But do want to say, we are actually likely going to have a few more with that event before we're all said and done. We're exploring some other damage photos and videos that are coming in. But again, I think the great news with all of this is we also have not heard of any significant injuries and obviously no fatalities. So on an event like that or a day like that, that's fantastic.
That is indeed, Alan. So our EF scale rating looks at damage to find out what the estimated winds were. I noticed a number of the tornadoes, EF0, that's sort of 75 to 85 miles per hour. EF2, you mentioned the strongest, goes up over 100 miles an hour?
Correct, yep. And in this case, they also, when they put in the damage, they look at the photos, examine all of it, what occurred and whatnot. And for all these tornadoes, you know, we try to put in a maximum estimated wind. So in this case, again, I'll throw out the word preliminary. Again, it's subject to change a little bit as we finalize it all. But with that specific tornado, we have currently max estimated wind of 130 miles per hour. So again, certainly nothing to toy with.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, another silver lining, in addition to having no injuries reported so far, significant rain in much of the state this week. How much and where?
Yeah, like I said, you know, fortunately we got, you know, actually a pretty wet spring in general so far. So with the Tuesday rain and then even the rain we just got recently yesterday, for the most part, there were areas of the state that saw 1-2 plus inches, namely kind of the southern and eastern areas. And it has actually put a pretty good dent in the overall drought, especially if you look back from, you know, the beginning of this calendar year through really this week. We've seen there's still a few areas with some severe drought, namely the northeast, but significant reductions across the south, northwest, central, you know, large swaths of the state. And I'm not sure if a lot of our viewers are aware, we break drought out in short-term and long-term. Short-term kind of being your seasonal, you know, corn, soybean, those sorts of activities. And in terms of that, we're actually looking really good across the state. Very little short-term types of drought, but people more concerned about well water, groundwater, reservoirs, things like that. We still have some lingering concerns, so we're not quite out of the water in that regard.
Alan, what can you say about the weather in the coming days?
If anyone's looking for kind of like your cooler spring or more of your traditional spring type weather, we have plenty of that over the next, you know, 3 to 5, 7 days or so. Cool conditions, we're looking at widespread highs ranging from the mid-50s up through the 60s, like I said, from today through much of next week. And if anyone's looking for a little bit more rain, I know some of the farmers are trying to get out in the field, so maybe they would like it to hold off a little longer. But we're going to see chances come through early in the week on Monday, and then a second round late week, kind of Thursday night into Friday. And it's really early to say, but if we're going to look for an opportunity for some thunderstorms or some stronger ones, it would be late next week.
Alan Curtis, National Weather Service meteorologist. Thank you so much, Alan.
Yeah, not a problem. Happy to do this.
Coming up after a short break, how you can volunteer to collect valuable data about the health of your local stream. When our news buzz continues, it's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
And we're back with more of this News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News on this Friday, April 19th. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wow, so grateful for the plentiful rains this week across the state, right? Getting higher levels into our rivers and streams. The Isaac Walden League's Save Our Streams program is the only nationwide program training volunteers to protect waterways from pollution, also to bring information about water quality to their communities. Anybody can get trained as a volunteer stream monitor in this program. Anybody can collect valuable data about the health of their local stream. Rich Walker is an assistant professor of biology at Upper Iowa University in Northeast Iowa. He trains volunteers in this program to test water, and I spoke with him earlier this week. Rich Walker, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Start off by generally telling us about water testing conducted by volunteers here in Iowa. Most of our listeners are unacquainted with that, I'm sure.
Yes, I don't think that a lot of people know about this program. So the program that I kind of help do volunteer trainings for, testing water quality and assessing stream health here in Iowa. And actually, this, I should step back and say that this is actually a nationwide initiative set up by the Isaac Walden League of America as an opportunity for citizens to become involved in issues of water quality and trying to better understand the health of our stream ecosystems that, you know, we so dearly rely on. The training itself involves kind of two components. There's a couple of online webinars that kind of get you initiated with the materials. One of those webinars involves listening to the basics in testing water quality and getting familiar with the different test kits that you would use during the field component of our training. The second webinar involves introduction to macroinvertebrates, and those, for those that aren't familiar with macroinvertebrates, these are the insects and bugs that you might find in your stream if you were to go pick up a rock and watch these bugs crawling around. That second webinar kind of introduces you to the different types of macroinvertebrates that are very helpful in understanding the health of a stream. And then the third webinar really deals with specific regional aspects of training for with different introductory material. So this was originally set up in the Chesapeake Bay, and this whole program started there, and they've adapted this for a nationwide assessment. And so there's different regional trainings for the different areas.
So once you have these webinars completed, what's the next step of training?
Once you've completed the online webinars, you should take a macroinvertebrate identification quiz. This gets you a little certification that you'll receive from that after you pass this quiz. And it's really honestly a very broad level macroinvertebrate identification exam. And it basically tells you if you're looking at a stonefly, a mayfly, crayfish, or any of those other broad level insects that you might come across. So you'll take that exam, you get a certification for that, and then you're essentially ready to go join for the in-person field training component.
And so you go out in the field in a stream. You're there in Northeast Iowa at Upper Iowa University in Fayette. So you take the people who pass the test out in the field and do what with them?
Well, we actually go through all the stuff they learned in those online webinars. Like I said, the webinars are to get them familiar with the equipment and things that they might be looking at in the field. And then the training in the field is actually to give them really that hands-on experience and put that information they learned from the webinars to the test and essentially evaluate with all of the stuff they learned. Essentially, can we figure out, is this a healthy stream or is this a stream in poor condition? And using all of that data to essentially determine the health of the streams that we're sampling.
Talk a little bit more about the small creatures that you are interested in most in determining the health of a stream. Well, why are they a good indicator of what's going on in a stream?
It's a great question. So we often will use different assessment tools to determine the health of a stream. The first line of testing is essentially testing the water quality. So we look at phosphorus, we look at other nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus, we look at salts that enter the stream, sediments. That's kind of a first line of, is the stream condition kind of out of whack? You know, if our values for phosphorus and nitrogen are too high, that might be an indicator that we might have issues in the stream. Next, we use, the next level up, we use macroinvertebrates. These small invertebrates really give us a more longer picture or longer term picture, if you will. So like I said, the water quality is a quick upfront how the health of the stream looks, but the macroinvertebrates are there and they really tell you really that health of the stream more long term. So have we had long term increases in nutrients or long term increases in sediments in the stream? And by assessing which critters are there and essentially how many of them are there, we can evaluate the actual health and condition of the stream to determine whether managers or conservation activists should go in and do some mitigation or restoration efforts to help hopefully improve those streams and bring them back to a good standing condition.
Rich, what is the need for volunteers to get trained, as you've just described, and to be certified? Is there a great need for volunteers to do this?
There is a huge need. I think the more individuals that we have participating in these volunteer programs, the more we're going to learn and understand about the streams and the water bodies and watersheds that actually basically sustain you know, our society and being able to, you know, thrive and do the things we want to do. So I think it's very important that we get more people involved and interested in these types of things, because if we don't protect these resources, then eventually this could have detrimental effects to the human population as far as, you know, if the water quality isn't good, then we'd want to make sure that we're not taking in and drinking that water if it's bad for our health. And so having these volunteers really do these nationwide assessments and more people doing this is going to be very helpful and kind of guiding managers and conservationists to where they need to put additional efforts into conservation and management.
Rich, to anyone considering doing this, volunteering to test water in Iowa streams, do you need any previous experience or knowledge? What type of people are good for this?
I'm going to tell you the truth, you don't need any experience whatsoever. As long as you have an interest and a drive in protecting our natural resources and you want to get involved in your community and do some volunteering in your community, I think that's really all you need.
So I understand, Rich, when you become a volunteer to test Iowa water quality in streams, you're provided with a testing kit. What's in that?
That's a good question. There are actually a couple of different kits that kind of get put together to do a full assessment. One of those kits deals with looking at chloride or chlorine in the stream. So a big emerging stressor of interest that people are interested in is freshwater salinization. So we are trying to do a lot more and put a lot more effort into monitoring salts that enter our streams. So one of the test kits test for additional chloride in the stream. One of those test kits is essentially a 3-in-1 or a 5-in-1 test strip. So like say you wanted to test the water quality of your swimming pool, it's very similar where you stick this test strip down in the water and wait a few seconds and eventually you compare that to a color coordinated identifier, and it tells you essentially the value that you're seeing and reading as far as the phosphorus levels or nitrogen goes. We also test for turbidity. Turbidity is essentially an additional sediments that are suspended within the water column. And so we have a particular piece of equipment that actually will help us measure how much nutrient or how much sediments are in the water column.
Rich, I think you probably awakened the interest in people concerned and those who want to be hands-on in helping the environment and water testing. How do people find out more and possibly become a volunteer?
Yes, they can reach out to me at Upper Iowa University. They can send me an email, or they can actually go onto the Isaac Walton League of America's website and type in the Save Our Streams monitoring program, and that has a lot of information there where you can get started in taking those webinars and contacting local officials in your area that are associated with the Isaac Walton League in your region, and they'll get you signed up for the volunteer monitoring efforts.
Okay, very good. Rich Walker, you can contact him at Upper Iowa University, or as he said, look online for the Isaac Walton League of America to find out more information. Rich, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Going into Monday night's WNBA draft, Iowa's Caitlin Clark was the overwhelming favorite to be the first overall pick. And that weekend, she had made an appearance on SNL, Saturday Night Live, and shared the stage at the end of the show with three of her teammates who were there to support her. Iowa guard Kate Martin had declared for the draft, but hadn't been officially invited to attend the event. So it was a delightful surprise when Martin's name was called as the 18th pick by the Las Vegas Aces. WQAD was with Martin's family when the pick was announced.
With the 18th pick in the 2024 WNBA draft, the Las Vegas Aces select Kate Martin.
Martin spoke with ESPN at the event.
I'm really happy to be here. I was here to support Caitlin, but, you know, I was hoping to hear my name called, and all I wanted was an opportunity, and I got it, so I'm really excited.
Coach Lisa Bluter called Martin the glue of the Iowa team for her leadership on the court and in the locker room. Martin served as captain of the Iowa women's team for four seasons. This was the first time since 1998 that Iowa had two players selected in the draft. Congratulations to both women. And that just about does it for this News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. Let's groove into the weekend. CeCe Mitchell is with us from IPR Studio One. Hi, CeCe.
Hey there, Ben.
I see there's plenty of information and the Iowa Public Radio website about the upcoming festivals, music festivals to be enjoyed this summer.
Sure thing. Yeah, we just had the AD35 lineup announced, and you can check out that lineup over at iprstudio1.org. And also an earlier article about the Hinterland Festival over in St. Charles. I've got a couple of selections of tracks by Hinterland artists to share with you today.
Well, excellent. Let's go for it. What do you have for the first one?
Sure thing. The first track, it's by the band Vampire Weekend. They've been a really successful indie rock band for quite some time, and they just released their highly anticipated fifth album. It's called Only God Was Above Us. They're playing the Hinterland Festival this summer, so even if you don't plan to go to that festival, the new album is definitely worth a listen. So here's one of the singles from that new record, Prep School Gangsters.
Prep School Gangsters make the call. As the summer turns to fall.